This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So we're about to start the third session. I'll just introduce the chair of this session, which is called Layers of Significance, Local Sites. So I'd like to introduce you to Margot Neal. Margot is Principal Advisor to the Director on Indigenous Affairs here at the Museum. She's also a Senior Research Fellow at our Centre for Historic Studies and a Senior Curator here at the Museum. And she's also an Adjunct Professor in Australia at the Australian Centre for Indigenous History at the ANU. Thank you very much, Margot.
Thank you. I think we're behind time now with all those little titles. Oh, yeah, right. He's looking at my shoes. I wear red shoes so you don't look at my face, you only look at my feet. It's to do with age, memory losers, losses, and so on. So this session is called Layers of Significance, Local Sites. And it's a very, I have to say, a very variegated and highly textured terrain, this next session up till 4:30, because we start off with a conversation between between one, two, three people plus a convener who is Amar Gala. I think I don't necessarily need to introduce Amar again for those who were here today. He gave the keynote. But he is Professor Amar Gala, University of Queensland, and in brief, he's an expert in museum sustainable development and poverty alleviation through culture. So he'll be convening this conversation we have here today. And the other speakers we have are all sort of connected almost through NCA, the National Capital Authority, and Reconciliation Place. They all overlap in those areas. They still have their own little moments beyond that, and some quite considerable. So we have... I'll just get the... Benita Tunks, who worked for me for a while. I'm actually having a bit of trouble finding my piece, who is an artist. So we have Andrew Smith, second there to Mandy. So I'll start with Mandy. Mandy is actually, I'm not going to go through all of this clearly because it's all written down so beautifully. All I'm going to say is she has an arts law background. She's worked in Indigenous Affairs since 2001 and she now works with FACSIA. And I love FACSIA. They gave me the biggest mob of money for the next, which Peter will tell you about later, for another big symposium coming up. So she is rightfully in the first seat. And she has connections with the other mob, with NCA and all of that business. So next is Andrew Smith. Now, Andrew Smith is a registered architect, planner and urban designer, and he's worked in both public and private sectors. He's a survivor. He's been an NCA through the razor cuts and the guillotining and so on, and he's still there, so obviously he's got a lot to contribute and to offer. His work, again, includes Reconciliation Place, the National Police Memorial, and Australians of the Year Walk, probably other things as well. Now, Benita Tunks, no, Garmar's next, who we've already introduced. Next is Benita. She's a director of a Liquid Creative Projects, which is a small Canberra-based company which specialises in design and project management of exhibitions and cultural institutions. She's currently working at the museum in public programs. And I think we've got them covered. So, Amar, hand over to the able Amar, who will get this mob stimulated and keep the dialogue going.
Thanks, Margot. One quick question. Did you walk with those wonderful shoes in Reconciliation Place? All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Have people got this little booklet? There's some copies here. Yeah, there's some here. But before we start this, in fact, when the National Museum organized this, nobody knew that I had a little past with this. Years ago, long, long time ago, the National Capital Authority commissioned me to write a concept for Reconciliation Place, working with the indigenous people, with the tent embassy and all the different families. But then a man half my size became the Prime Minister of Australia and I disappeared into the distance. And this is the first time since then that I'm actually, you know, sort of looking forward to learning what has happened. What's happened is the original concept, well, this, you still got the same title, Reconciliation Place, yes, sort of, but it's changed into something different. So that's great. And Andrew has survived indeed, because I knew Andrew. He was a young man then, still looking young, you know, while I'm aging. But he survived. I mean, he was there when I was working on it, and he was there when Johnny was there as the Prime Minister, and he's there still. So tell us, you know, I think, you know, given all the changes that have taken place, how does Reconciliation Place get used today?
Okay, can I just ask, how many people understand or know what Reconciliation Place is? Because I might be beneficial. Most people understand.
Please, if you heard of.
And you understand the spatial construct and how it all works. Okay. All right. What we've got, for the, in short, Reconciliation Place was an idea that was floating around, as Ma has said, and then in parallel with that, the authority had done some work on how the parliamentary zone might be redeveloped or how provide a strategic plan for its ongoing development, and that work was done in the late 1990s, and that led to a report being produced in March of 2000. Now, in that document, there was a couple of there were four key initiatives which the authority committed to deliver over the coming years. Almost in parallel with that, the former Prime Minister advised us that, in fact, there would be something called what he called the Reconciliation Square, and asked us to provide advice on how that might be manifested in the parliamentary zone. We took one of the ideas from that master planning process, which MR was involved in, which was, in fact, what at that stage called the East-West Promenade, and we put forward the idea that Reconciliation Place could actually be used to connect the eastern and western sides of the parliamentary zone, the reason being that at that stage we've identified that it was such a large area that people found it very disconnected, and we needed something to bring particularly the cultural institutions together. That idea was supported. We held an international design competition, and the scheme for Reconciliation Place was selected as the winner. Its simple components are a pathway, as we'd envisaged. Along that pathway are artworks or slivers, as they were initially described. And in the centre and on the land axis is a, I guess it's a mound, essentially. And what the concept here was that Reconciliation Place in itself reflected the journey of reconciliation. Each of these artworks told a story about the relationship between Indigenous or non-Indigenous Australians. And as people moved through the artworks, they would have an individual experience of reconciliation. And the idea of the mound, which was to basically provide a spot to stop and pause. And in fact, it's high enough so you can look down on the artworks, and the idea being, of course, that you can reflect, look back at the journey you've undertaken and look forward to the journey you're about to undertake. It was intended that not be developed at once, but to be developed over time. And in 2002, I think it was, the first four slithers or artworks were unveiled. And then, I suppose, nearly every second year since then, one or two additional artworks have been developed and installed in Reconciliation Place. So today we've got about 17 pieces, all of which have a different interpretation, tell a different story of the reconciliation process or talk about Indigenous people. There's no sort of great curatorial overlay here. It's the stories are told as they become relevant. So today Reconciliation Place tends to be used as an unstructured and informal way of informing visitors to the National Capital about Indigenous Australians. There are groups of Indigenous Australians who come and visit it occasionally, but that's often associated with if any particular artwork or relates to their own personal experience. Most commonly, it's used by school groups who see quite in quite a public place a story or get told a story about Indigenous Australia.
Thanks, Andrew. And tell me, is it still 2042? You're going to have, you know, that was like the commissioners said, you know, you plan till 2042, or is there?
No, there's no real timeline.
There's no timeline now, so that's it. I mean, it's timeless now. So.
I think the point is when people stop seeing the value of it, we've probably reached a point of reconciliation. While people want to tell their stories, it's still there for the stories to be told.
Well, how do you select, you know, the themes, the stories?
Okay. Well, essentially, it's a cross-government initiative. FACSIA, we work very closely with FACSIA, and I...
You didn't have to move closer to Mandy, you know?
No. We get to points where we'll just say, look, we've got expertise in design, we've got expertise in construction, and we've got expertise in procurement and artwork. What the NCA doesn't have expertise in is working with Indigenous people or identifying themes and issues that are important to those. And so in a lot of ways, we develop solutions that respond to issues that are raised by FACSIA.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's where, Mandy, you might want to take over, yeah.
Thank you. Can I just acknowledge the traditional owners on the land which are meeting today and pay my respects to their elders, both past and present? I work in FACSIA, and we have the responsibility for reconciliation and for erection, development of reconciliation place. It's supposed to represent, from our point of view, a shared journey of reconciliation, like Andrew's mentioned. It's a prominent location linking the heart of Canberra's parliamentary zone, which places it physically and symbolically at the heart of Australia's democratic life. So Andrew's been through the course of development of the reconciliation place as it is, with the 17 works that have been installed, and it's a work in progress, potentially so. I guess I'd like to put a bit more context around reconciliation place as far as the government's concerned. So following on from the apology to Australia's Indigenous peoples in February 2008 and in working towards closing the gap in Indigenous disadvantage, the current government's looking to forge new relationships with Indigenous people based on mutual respect and responsibility. The government recognises that an important part of resetting that relationship with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and in achieving successful outcomes is involving them in the decisions that affect them. And to this end, the government's engaging with a broad range of stakeholders on a variety of issues, not just reconciliation place. Its commitment to a new National Indigenous Representative Body is an example of this new approach. In the same way, Indigenous communities are a part of the development of reconciliation place. The involvement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists, communities and cultural advisors in the development of reconciliation place and its artworks has been integral since its inception. The original proposal for reconciliation place required that all design entry teams had to include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. In addition, the steering committee and the competition jury also included Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander members. The process has always involved working closely with the families and communities of the artists and Indigenous leaders whose images, words or stories were chosen for the projects. Many of the materials were carefully sourced in accordance with respecting the protocols and interests of Indigenous communities. For example, the five stones that form the base of the artworks which celebrate the resilience and achievements of eminent Indigenous Australians were sourced from Wilcannia, New South Wales. The traditional owners asked that payment for the stones be made in the form of a donation to the Flying Doctor Service. A smoking ceremony took place before the stones were installed, and during the unveiling in Canberra, a sixth carved stone was also unveiled in Wilcannia as a further testament to the power of reconciliation. The Wilcannia stone was carved by a local artist, Badger Bates, and is a source of immense pride for the region. For the Torres Strait Islander artwork, Mathalu Thari by Vic McGrath, as well as for Fire and Water by Judy Watson, and Man and Woman Yam by Then Kupi, eminent Indigenous artists and advisors were sought from all over Australia to create designs that would resonate with many different audiences. The most recent artwork, a paving artwork featuring a mural mosaic designed by the Walakalanga Artists Aboriginal Corporation of Uendamu, was unveiled in November last year. The paving artwork was developed in partnership between the government, the Canberra Medical Society and the Yuendamu artists. As part of its care for its members in Wallakalanga, organised for artists to receive specialist medical care, otherwise not available in remote Central Australia, through the generous assistance of the Canberra Medical Society. With the agreement of the Medical Society, the artist's fees for the paving artwork, rather than paying for the medical care, went back to Yuendamu community and towards a community swimming pool, which was a top priority for the community. The Yuendamu community worked together to get the swimming pool in partnership with government and the private sector, developing positive relationships which benefit the whole community. So we see Reconciliation Place, I guess, Amar, as an example of that in action, working with Indigenous communities to achieve the outcomes.
Thanks, Mandy. That's great. Now, before I hand over to the project manager and one of the artists involved, I just want to say to you, you know, sort of the whole thing we're talking about, you know, a very strong bicultural Indigenous, non-Indigenous collaboration here, and yet you're looking at four people, none of us are Indigenous, Australians. So before you actually, you know, ask that question, I just want to say that actually I felt very comfortable being the convener with a situation like this. We got an Indigenous Australian with very colourful shoes welcoming us and introducing us, so she's empowered in us in some ways. But the most important thing that I've always felt, I've worked on probably one of the biggest research projects with the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, that Aboriginal people have nothing to reconcile with us. It's all of us that have to reconcile. So in that spirit, I feel, you know, very, very comfortable with this situation. I just want you to know that we are conscious of this, but in every sense of the word, you know, this is great what's happening, and there'll be time for questions. Okay, now to Benita.
Well, I do want to mention that three Indigenous artists that were involved in the project were invited, but they were actually busy, so they couldn't attend this. So there was interest. My role was as an artist working on the project, and when I was first approached, I actually said no. I was worried how it was going to evolve, and yes, the lack of Indigenous people represented on the project did concern me. But Sharon Payne, one of the members of the winning group of people that were selected for the project, came and had a discussion with me and actually shared with me that if we didn't start to create a place for Indigenous Australians to tell their story and to share with non-Indigenous Australians, then it would never begin, and we needed to make that process start. And so one of the things that I was very conscious of was the consultation process that was put in place, and also ensuring its authenticity. Mm. And I suppose the things that I wanted to share with you today was my privileged opportunity to actually interact with the families, hear their stories, work with them directly to realise some of their designs or drawings or images or texts that they wanted to integrate into the structures. When I first was on board with the project, it was quite, they were known as slivers in the early days, and I understood why they were slivers, but I always thought they were a bit cold and clinical, and for a story that is very much based in country and connection to land, I was really keen to see some really earthy things happening out there. So when I was approached on the third stage, so I was involved in the first three stages, I was pleased as punch that I could go and find stones that actually told the stories and were able to represent the stories in a more organic, earthier way. So, and then what's been really nice for me as a local living here, as well as someone who's been involved in the project, is watching the way Reconciliation Place has evolved over time, and the artworks are really becoming quite diverse, and the structures that we first established in that first stage are pretty much not used anymore, which is fantastic. And as I said to Andrew the other day, I'd like to see them removed one day. But as he said, it's a representation of the stages of the Reconciliation Place. But I just wanted to share with you that from my perspective, working on the project and interacting with the families and being able to sort of get very close to the communities and spending time in the communities, that's what informed my work and the marks that were made on these structures. And I look forward to watching all the different artworks evolve there over time.
Well, thanks, Benita. Well, it's rather than the place itself, you know, the place is a powerful symbol, you know, sort of, and the way Mandy also explained, you know, the connections to the communities, you know, from the place. Now, I'm very conscious that, you know, a lot of you have not just questions but some comments to make too, but could you keep them very short? And if you want to ask a question to the panel, anyone? Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah. Just 1 minute. The microphone, because.
Hi, my name is Beth. I'm from ACT Historic Places. I'm a bit concerned about vandalism. I know it is in the Parliamentary Triangle, but are there any special steps you've taken to protect the artworks?
Andrew? In short, no. We're quite fortunate. Most of the public works, the memorial, commemorative works, and artworks that we have are not really subject to much vandalism at all. There's only been one or two breakages of the glass, and in that case it was just because a truck reversed into it.
It was one of the workers.
But no, we're not concerned about that at all. It's not an issue for us.
Okay, who's going to go next? Yeah.
Can you give me an idea of... it's Faye Powell from the Australian War Memorial. Can you give me an idea of the meaning that this has for Aboriginal people? Is this reconciliation place more meaningful than, say, the Aboriginal Tent Embassy site?
That's a difficult one to answer, I think. I hear differing views from Aboriginal people about reconciliation itself, so I presume they would have the same used towards Reconciliation Place. Some Aboriginal people think that reconciliation is white man's business. We've got to get our act together in order to engage with them. And others are quite willing to accept it's a two-way street. So I think there's probably a range of views, and I wouldn't dare to suggest there is one particular view on that.
Thanks, Mandy.
Just over the first three stages that I was involved in, the first opening, as soon as it was opened, everyone dispersed. The second opening, everyone hung around and we had to cancel lunch, and we actually stayed on the site, and a lot of the Indigenous families and communities that flew in were really chuffed that this place was there. And on the third one, we didn't even make a lunch appointment off-site. We actually had lunch on-site because people just sat and talked. And I really noticed over the, I think, 4 or 5 years that I was involved, that the people who are associated with the making of the stories and the artworks really were claiming it as their own site. So that was just an observation that I made.
I think it's a very important question. And given that I do exist somewhere, you know, sort of in the archaeological layer of that place, I might add, two things were fairly critical. One, I think there's only Professor Mulwaney and Julie who are aware of a symposium, one-day symposium, that was held when the government made the decision, you know, to move the National Museum from Yarramundi to the Parliamentary Triangle. Of course, it couldn't happen. And the whole question of symbolism and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Committee of the National Museum made a very strong representation to put us at the foot of the old Parliament House, which has been responsible for so much disadvantage, you know, so many policies, is not acceptable. I remember Bob McMullen, he was a senator, chaired it. Margaret Reynolds took the recommendation. And so that there was, you know, very strong feeling, you know, it's because of that symposium that I convened, where we had Roger Pergram, Professor Mulwaney, Peter Piggott, Dick Smith, and Lawrence Neal, and people like that actually speaking. And that then this Brendan, the CEO of NCPA, as it was called then, when I was asked, I said, oh, look, let me ask the Aboriginal people. You know, there were four different families who were
involved with the tent embassy. So I went there and I spent a bit of time talking to different people. You know, what do you think about this? National Capital Authority is thinking of something very powerful here. I also talked to all the national institutions because they were all like inward looking. You know, everything happened inside the national institutions, but not outside. National Gallery has the sculpture garden on one side, which was just evolving. And so we consulted everybody, but the first point was the sausage sizzle at the tent embassy. And there was very strong support for it. You know, as long as, you know, Aboriginal people are involved in the whole participatory process that has been clearly explained by our speakers, that's fine. And so I don't know if between all of us, have we answered your question?
That the actual spot was more important to the family, and I thought the actual, I don't know, but I would have thought the actual spot that would be more meaningful to Aboriginal people would have been the tent embassy, because of what it, you know, what flowed from that time, mm-hmm. rather than this, which is very, it's beautiful, but I just wondered whether it does have that memory, and you're saying that it does, so...
Well, it was seen as, you know, there were several things that could be done there. I mean, the first thing was, what happens? Does it mean that the tent embassy, you know, we have to remove this? I said, no, I don't think anybody is saying that, you know. So that was rather than just one. There's, you know, Indigenous Australia, non-Indigenous Australia is very culturally diverse. And there's room for many forms of cultural expressions. And many forms of protest, if you like, through art. Art is a very powerful tool for protest and resistance, if you like. So there was that broad consensus, you know, with all the Aboriginal people who were first consulted, that there's room for, you know, sort of more creativity there. Yeah.
Also, this space is a very new space, and we won't know for a long time how people interact with it. And it's for all Australians. And so, as someone mentioned earlier, there's a lot of non-Indigenous Australians who don't know a lot of the stories. So if they're visiting the site and they're engaging with the stories and the information that's there, then that's one... group of people that are participating. What other groups do with that site over time, it's yet to be seen.
Okay, any other questions, comments? You still got 10 minutes.
Thank you. I'm Anne from the National Museum. I went there not so long ago with my mum, and the way that I got there was going through the new National Portrait Gallery, coming out of the coffee shop, and then heading over to the National Library. And I just wonder if you can comment on how the you know, how those institutions impact on the way that people, the traffic flow, I guess, more than anything else, but whether you have other mechanisms for encouraging people to follow that pathway.
Yeah, I guess it's a question for me. It was always the intention that the Reconciliation Place pathway would be flanked by large institutional buildings. It was, but those projects don't come along very often. You know, you mentioned the National Portrait Gallery. The preceding new building in the Parliamentary Zone was actually Questacon, and that was finished in 1998. So we're looking at every 20 or so years, someone's brave enough to do a new building there. We don't, our experience is there's no sort of issues associated with the juxtaposition of those buildings. There's the entries to the buildings, in particular case the National Portrait Gallery, are sited in a way that people can access Reconciliation Place. I mentioned at the beginning that the siting was in part set by a sort of a broader urban design objective to link, in this case, the entrance to the National Gallery and the National Library. So if it's your shopping centre sort of parlance, they're the anchor tenants of the parliamentary zone, then it was quite, the intention was quite, was there to make Reconciliation Place the places you've got, the area you've got to walk through to actually experience the cultural institutions of the PZ.
You happy with that answer, Anne? Mm-hmm. About, I think that, just to add to that, I mean, that was anticipated that there would be more engagement between all the institutions. What people have to remember is this concept, the whole thing started only a year or two after National Capital Attractions was established. Before that, every institution was marketing themselves separately. So the kind of collaboration that was coming together between all the national institutions is not all that long ago. So we thought this is great. This is another way all these institutions could interact, engage, and the Reconciliation Place becomes the stomping ground, if you like, you know? Yeah, so thank you. Margot.
Oh, hi. Would it be correct to say that the that site is, that this whole, the Reconciliation Place is in fact a government initiative? It's correct to say that, isn't it? Yes. Obviously responding to needs from non-Indigenous and Indigenous, and probably from the Reconciliation Council would have had some push there too, I imagine. Anyway, the point I'm making in context of the layers of meaning and the citing here is that someone mentioned the Tent Embassy. So on one hand, we've got the Tent Embassy, which is a people, black people's initiative on Aboriginal country, reclaimed, I have to say, again. And over on this site here, of course, we've got an underlayer of Indigenous country. It's Indigenous country. And sort of then there's a European layer. So one's actually, so even the sort of correspondence between the two sites have a very interesting conversation in terms of one is seen on the surface, at least, without the going below as I just did. On the surface, you have these Indigenous kind of people power initiative, and then you have the government initiative on the other end, and then you've got this all this layering and the conversations in between. But that's probably a paper I should do one day.
Yeah, and thrown into all of this, you said European Indigenous is a bloody Indian, you know, sort of involved.
Paul House, just want to ask a question of my family, through my mother Matilda, has been involved with the Reconciliation. I sort of seen firsthand what's happened there, and I think personally, I think it's good to see what's going on, and I think it's a long journey. It's a start in a long journey into the future in terms of reconciliation in Australia. It's symbolic. It's very symbolic, but I think it's deeper than that as well. I mean, it's also relationship building, personal relationships between individuals and government structures. But the question I want to ask is, I hope that it doesn't take away potentially a future act of acknowledgement in terms of the Indigenous wars in Australia. Mm. That one of the things I see missing probably in the ACT is a memorial on Anzac Parade to acknowledge the Indigenous wars in Australia. Mm. And unfortunately, there's a bit of acknowledgement behind the National Museum. Sort of, a lot of people say it's out of sight, out of mind. Mm. But I'd like to see something along Anzac Parade, but hopefully this won't sort of be used as an excuse not to do something like that in the future.
Thanks, Paul. There's still 6 minutes left.
I'm a time gestapo. I'm just putting up the flag, that's all. Time for more questions?
People are scared of you, standing there. You know, sort of, they won't ask questions. Okay.
Okay, Maria Nugent from the National Museum. I wanted to ask about, I'm just trying to understand, it's a series of local stories, is that right? So people know. So you said it's not curated in a sense of like a national historical perspective, so not sort of a story about kind of a white Australia's relationship to Aboriginal people, but instead a kind of portrayal of history as a series of regional or local stories. Is that right to say or not?
You want
to
start, Andrew?
I'll just make a brief comment because I think the others would probably add a lot more. But I think it is a series, a historical, trying to almost a grab bag of historical incidents and
eminent people and events that want to be remembered. I mean, there's some variation in it. I mean, just the Torres Strait Islander art is promoting art and culture. So it is a range of things, but underneath, I think, there's a definite attempt to try and get specific events like the Stolen Generations and things like that remembered there. So I think, yeah, probably a bit of both, but I could be wrong.
I think that's right. I think it's also, Benita made the point that it's a very young place. And so my observation of working through the last few years is that initially there were those sort of touchstone issues about the relationship that had to be addressed. And one of the most contentious was actually to do with the separation of children from their families. And in fact, that took two works to actually even begin to tell that story. And you know, I mean, probably find many people wouldn't even say it's been done adequately at this stage. So at the moment, we've got to remember it is young and that it's really the bigger issues, the sort of the headline issues that are being addressed. But each one universally does have a sort of a reconciliation theme and will work towards a shared journey.
Well, that was one of my concerns when I first was part of the project, was who selected the stories, and that was a question I asked Andrew at lunch today, because where do we go from here? Because I think some of the key stories have been told, and as I said, I'd like to see a kid's story, a group of children talking about how it's impacted on them. So I think it's now at a stage where OIPC and NCA need to sit down and say, well, where do we go from here? But I do know that on each project there's a curatorial or a cultural advisor, so they consult quite widely as to who are the women who should be telling their stories, who are the elders that should be representing Reconciliation Place. So I do know that they do a lot of talking to a whole lot of different areas, but I think it's now got to a stage where you hand it over to communities and people, and it's which communities, which people, and how far do you go? So I think that's where they're at right now.
Sorry, this is Heather again. Who's deciding the aesthetic in the sense of which piece goes near something else? Because it's very... What I'm seeing as you're all talking behind you, the loop behind you, sometimes things sit in a disjunctive fashion. Sometimes there's a visual statement and therefore a statement of certain other politics underneath that as to where things are placed. And who's deciding that?
You want to start?
The general structure of... of the process of designing and citing each of these work is guided by a steering committee or a reference committee, which FACSIA oversee and look after. The general approach is that we'll be asked to develop a work around a theme. Given the theme, the NCA or its sub-consultants will develop a proposal and cite it in accordance with... maybe urban design objectives, co-location with similar themes, relationships, particularly to Parliament House. The Neville Bonner sliver is a classic example of that, where we made sure you could look at the image of Bonner and look at Parliament House at the same time. So there's a combination of issues and thoughts in regard to the sighting and the character of each of the works.
Okay.
Do you need to follow that up? Okay, we'll just finish with that then.
I'm just thinking in relationship to the materiality of the works.
Sorry?
I'm thinking in relationship to the materiality of the works, so metal against stone, glass against angular structure, more organic structure, where they are placed in relationship to one another. That visual statement adds other layers of meaning.
As I said, the first stage was actually the design team was two teams, so it was the architectural team that won the competition, and then my company was brought on board to actually... Originally, it was described they were billboards and they were going to have words and text, but they didn't know me well enough, and I wanted to carve things out and put things in and wanted to use stone and glass and a whole lot of things. The elements were there. The architect had actually defined stainless steel, glass, but I just jumped up and down about stone, so he inserted some stone. But that's why I say those first five, even though, I mean, I do love them, but the other works that followed have become, they've got more life, they've got more energy, they've got more soul. And so I think what was evident early on, and Andrew can probably speak about this as well, is that rather than have a really strict set of criteria about what the structure should be, let the story shape that. So that's why I was really excited about the stones, because by working with the five families and going and finding the stones and letting the whole process be more organic, then they used to be called slivers, they're now called artworks. So it shows the transition of that short period of time, that now they are artworks telling stories and they actually have a life about them, whereas the first structures, which were billboards, they are a little bit more clinical and cold. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I think that's, we might have to stop there, but I hope that, you know, sort of right in the beginning, Andrew said how many of you heard about the place and so on. There's a little, you know, that more people are aware of Reconciliation Place. And it is beginning to get a bit sunny in cold Canberra. It's a good time to go for a walk in Reconciliation Place. I strongly recommend that. But also, before I ask you to thank the... First, I'd like to ask you to thank the panelists, Mandy, Andrew, and Vanita. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank Margot for introducing us, a great mate, you know, sort of in these things, really takes on challenges. And also thank Leanne, because I didn't thank her this morning. Leanne, you did a great job bringing people together today. You know, would you all join me in thanking Leanne, please? Okay, so over to you.
Thank you, Amar. It's a great discussion, and it's almost too big to do. I'm sure it's actually too big to do justice to in a panel like this. But and it's very complex, and it obviously has. I was actually on the Indigenous Advisory Committee at one time. So what was really interesting about the fact that I was never called upon is a measure of success, because they were talking to the people whose stories were actually being put onto the into the Reconciliation Place. So that's one measure of its success in terms of consultation. And we do know that it's a start, and there are a lot of stories that would not be known if they weren't in a public place. Now, I want to, leading in, it's my great pleasure, in fact, to introduce you to Paul House. Paul House is a descendant of the Ngambri Ngunnawal man, Henry Black Harry Williams. And Paul, I'm not going through it all because you can read it all in leisure, but he was born here in the old Canberra Hospital in 1969. That's Paul, not Black Harry. And Paul has actually been involved. He's quite a remarkable young man. I can call him a young man because I'm significantly older, in that he has a lot of cultural community responsibilities and commitments, and they're listed here. He's also had quite a variegated public service career, very solid career through a number of organisations, starting at the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. He is currently employed, in fact, with the New South Wales Department of Environment and Climate Change as the manager, and it's a very long title. So he's involved in the whole cultural and heritage division being a local Indigenous man. He's connected strongly to this country, so his talk is about connection to country, to culture, to ancestors, and what is going to be useful, particularly for a lot of people, may not necessarily be you, Mob, but probably is, but he will give an Aboriginal face to Canberra in a historic context, which people and names that others at least, may not have heard of, such as Ong Yong and Nulup, and even Black Harry for a lot of people. He's, but not to stop there, of course, he's headed off, armed himself with a couple of degrees, and has just completed a bachelor degree in community management from Macquarie University in 07 and a diploma in government management in 02. Now, that all puts pay to the Australian perception that black fellas can be lazy and don't get on with stuff. I went to a reconciliation lecture given into, recently by Mick Dodson, and the statistics are alarming about what non-Indigenous Australians as a body think about the stereotype they have of Indigenous people. Now, I won't, it's not my place, it's now my honour to introduce Paul, who will be talking about National Living Treasures, a perspective on the history of the Ngambri and their story of survival. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Margot. Firstly, I'd like to thank the National Museum of Australia for the invitation to come down here today, to Leanne, to Barbara, all the National Museum staff for giving me the opportunity and acknowledgement to be here today. I put together this presentation a few years ago, and I probably need to update it, but I'd love to share it with you. It's about, titled it National Living Treasures, after our ancestors, after our people today, both in past and present, to honour our ancestors and our people today. And it's a perspective on the history of our mob and our story of survival. And this presentation, I could talk for a couple of hours on it, so I'm going to have to fast track it a bit. And you can see there the different subjects I'm going to quickly talk about with today. So I don't know whether there was a welcome to country today or an acknowledgement. Yeah, good. Maybe, since I'm here, I might just quickly welcome you to Ngambri country. I was fortunate to... My parents took a photo of me in front of the hospital where I was born back in 1970 there. And now, yeah, very special. Lucky for that to happen, a photo of country of me in front of my birthplace. So before I get started, Margot sort of introduced me a little bit. My friends, family and friends know me as Girawa. And on behalf of my ancestors, I would like to welcome you to the land of my birth, to the land of my ancestors, the land of the Ngambri. You're probably wondering what the word this Ngambri comes from. So Yetamura Ngambri Dara, welcome to Ngambri country. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the ancestors for laying such a strong foundation for the younger generation to move forward. The name Canberra is derived from the name of our ancestral group, and was gazetted in 1832 as Canberra Station, right here, by J.J. Moore. J.J. Moore was a property owner here. And different renditions. And so what we see today, Canberra is a Romanised, anglicised version of the word Ngambri. Different names here, you can see the different renditions. And this photo image comes from the Canberra CMAG, the local museum here in the ACT. So you're probably wondering, where is country? Just an image of our connection back to country. We're heavily involved into reviving our language, our cultural practices. And I've got the younger generation there performing with the older generation. So where is Ngambri country? This map is produced by a local historian, Anne Jackson Akana. She was an English-born author, and the map basically is a linguistic map, and it shows country based in linguistics, and our country, Canberra country, the different renditions you can see there, Canberra, same word Ngambri. Our ancestors, our people are Wolgaloo speaking people, and why we know so much about all this is because the records, the ethno-historical records, are powerful, they're compelling, and they clearly demonstrate our connection to country. And Anne Jackson's work, she drove along to Sydney one day, and she only got as far as Wirrawa, which is Lake George, And she sat there and contemplated her future in life, and she thought, oh, I wonder who the local mob are. And probably a big mistake, she didn't get to Sydney. She turned back and researched the Ngambri for the next 15 years of her life. And the evidence, once again, is very powerful. And unfortunately, local government sort of ignore that evidence at the moment. So we're looking at country here. You can see country stretches from Wirriwa, Lake George, over to the right there, along the Yass River, coming up to the junction of the Yass and Murrumbidgee, down near Burrinjuck, south of Yass Plains, south of the Yass River, all the way down to north of Cooma, along the Murrumbidgee River, into including all modern-day ACT, Queanbeyan, and west out to the Gondawarras, also known as the Brindabellas. And we had a brother-sister clan called the Gurumal, the Nyurmal. They were also Wolgaloo-speaking people as well, and they occupied the high country. And this map is based on where our ancestors were living, working, and passed away when Europeans first arrived on the horizon back in the 1820s in the local area. And you can see, I won't go into too much of the politics, maybe later, but the name Wallabaloa people, I have multiple Aboriginal ancestry. My great-great-grandfather, Henry Williams, you'll get to see him in a minute, he was essentially a multilingual Wolgaloo speaker, and he was born in the upper Murrumbidgee River. We'll get to see him in a minute. But the term Ngunnawal is a linguistic term, and it describes the Wallabaloa people north of the Yass River. And unfortunately, we'll talk about it a bit more as we go on, because there's a lot of controversy at the moment about country, rights to country, who can speak for country. My grandmother was a Wallabaloa Pajong lady, and she was a Ngunnawal speaker from north of the Yass River. So I acknowledge all my ancestries. So we talk about country here. Country expanded and contracted over many thousands of years, pre- and post-contact period. And Aboriginal people had rights to country, individual rights, group rights to country, and in traditional times and also in contemporary times today. So in a lot of the ancestors, what we find is a lot of ancestors were named after country. Where they were born, they were given a name from that area of country. For example, one of our leaders when the Europeans arrived on the horizon was an Aboriginal man called Onyong. His real name is Ali Nyonga, and he was born in a creek near Wirriwa, near Lake George. I'll just go on a little bit more. I'll quickly go through this. This is a map, an early map of Canberra, one of the first known maps of Canberra by Surveyor Dixon. And you can see we call it the Ngambri River, but now it's named the Molonglo River, and now it's called Lake Burley Griffin. And the Ngambri River flowed up to near Queanbeyan, up into what you call the Jullagung. And we can see country there. You can see Black Mountain and Mount Ainslie up in the top there, and Pialigo. So just quickly going back here to the invasions of Ngambri country. So when the Europeans did first arrive or invaded Ngambri country, our ancestors never seen a European person before, and there's stories in the family, you know, of the ancestors running up the tops of trees, trying to escape and running into the mountains out in the Gondawarras to escape from the Europeans. So at first, we know that Europeans slowly arrived as individuals and in small groups, so the ancestors were able to repel smaller groups, but after a time, the tide of people coming in the country, there was no competition. So who were the? This photo here is of the Lowe family. The gentleman on the far right is a gentleman named Dick Lowe, known as Black Dick. He was born in Kyandra. He is a Wolgaloo-speaking man from country here, a Nyurmal man, and that's his wife sitting down with a young daughter on her lap, Sarah McCartney Duncan. Sarah McCartney Duncan, with the hat on, is the daughter of a lady named Nanny. Nanny also known as Junamingo, was a Ngambri lady from the area who apparently had a relationship with James Ainslie, and that's their children there, Dick Lowe and Sarah McCartney Duncan. And unfortunately, 10 of their children never made it to adulthood. They died from influenza and measles. This photo was taken out at Cup of Cumberlong on the Murrumbidgee. And the lady on the right with the Mirigan, the dog, is Nellie Hamilton. Nellie was a Ngambri woman, a Molongalo woman, a Ngarrigo speaker as well. And she's a local identity from the Queanbeyan area. And there's a lot of evidence and records about all people here, including Nellie. And that was her third husband to the right there, King Billy, Bobby Duamunga from the South Coast. This is my great-great-grandfather, Henry Williams, known as Black Harry Williams. Him and Dick Lowe were great mates, great friends, and why we know so much about him, because the DeSalis family wrote in their diaries for over 40 years at a Cup and Cumberlong about Henry and Dick Lowe. He was a black tracker, he was a farmer, he was an athlete, he was a clever man, and he looked after country. He was born in the upper Murrumbidgee River in 1838, and this photo is taken at Yirra Yarra, where he worked as a labourer, as a stockman. He could turn his hand to anything. And I only recently found this photo about 4 or 5 years ago when I went out to a property called Fairlight Station, just on the border here in the ACT, near, which used to be a property of Yirra Yarra Station. And the Webb family kindly shared this image with the family. So Henry's mother was a Ngambri woman, and who died at a young age, and he was orphaned, and he was raised by our tribal grandfathers, Ali Nyonga and Nulup, also known as Jemmy the Rover. So he was about 65 years old in this photo, and Onyong and Nulup taught him the tribal secrets of country, and he easily disappeared into the mountains where he would practice law, custom, with the Nyirmal, the Wagalu-speaking mob. There's just an image of Henry's son, my great-grandfather, Lightning Williams, and my grandmother, Sissy Freeman, who was a Wallabalawa Wiradjuri woman over at Aboriginal Reserve in Yass called Hollywood. My grandfather, Doug. So there were many other ancestors as well. There was Kangaroo Tommy, Bobby Hamilton, Nanny and Nellie. And we know a lot about our ancestors. And because of the time, I'll just get through some of these photos. My mother, Matilda, with her great auntie, Violet, over at Yass in Hollywood. So what happened to the Ngambri? By the mid-1880s, the first generation of Ngambri who experienced whitefella invasion had passed away. We're talking about people like Onyong and Nulup, Kangaroo Tommy. So we're talking about multilingual ancestors who looked after country and held ceremony on country here. And eventually some of our ancestors, you know, a lot of our ancestors did die, pass away. And a lot of our mob did move on from country and were forcibly be removed out of country onto places like outside of country, places like Edgerton, Aboriginal Reserve near Yass, Hollywood, at Oak Hill, Yass, Brungle, Aboriginal Reserve, and further on to Cowra, Rambie Mission at Cowra. So slowly, a lot of the Ngambri people were slowly moved out of country, forced out of country, but some of our ancestors did remain on country here and look after country. My great-uncle, Roderick Williams, he was a labourer and worked on the building of Old Parliament House, and he worked as a labourer at Yarralumla Station just down here as well, which is now the Governor-General's residence. So this is a image of a acknowledgement of Onyong. Onyong developed a strong relationship with a man called Garrett Cotter. Garrett Cotter was an Irishman who was exiled over to the west of the Murrumbidgee River for allegedly stealing horse, and was and later exonerated. But during that time, he forged a strong relationship with Onyong, Black Harry's tribal grandfather, a Nyambri man, and helped Gokota survive in country. He showed him food, water, and country, and opened up, unbeknowing at the time, he opened country up to the Europeans. But there was a strong partnership and relationship, and that is reflected in the Gokota family acknowledging Onyong through a monument on their property out at Top Nace, out near Kapakumbalong, out at Nace Forest. So during this time, our ancestors were still living. In 1913, when the ACT was declared, the name was given Canberra as the national capital. Our ancestors, Black Harry Williams was still living and camping with Dick Lowe out at Yankee Hat, out at Namajee, Gudjimbi. We know that, and we've got stories in the family. Yankee Hat, Nullungbang, Gurumbang. And basically living and working on country. And why we know that is because of the ethno-historical records. Once again, they clearly demonstrate our provenance and connection to country. So we're talking about holding on to country. So the research, the records clearly indicate there were two main families that held on the country here in the ACT in the Canberra, include the descendants of Henry Williams and also the descendants of Dick Lowe, Richard Lowe, who was in that photo with Sarah McCartney Duncan. I might just go back to those images so you can just see. So, as you can see, our ancestors, we did exist. I grew up as a product of the ACT public education system. I was told that there were no Aboriginal people from the Canberra region and we didn't really have a name and we didn't exist. So, over time, things did slowly change. We'd done the research, we'd done our homework, and we connected ourselves back to country. And it's important that governments allow Aboriginal people to reconnect back to country and do it on their terms and do it in their way, not being dictated by government about who you are, where you come from, and who has rights to country. It's up to Aboriginal people to do that, to determine that, and not be interfered by government. I'm just going back. So holding on to country is very important. So we talk about moving on just quickly. When did we reclaim country? So as we see, over time, the ancestors were slowly moved out of country because of those policies of the time. In the late 19th and 20th centuries, herded on the two missions like cattle. And by that time, most of our ancestors were at Hollywood Reserve in Yass. So you can see in the land of our former enemies, the Wallabalawa, the Ngunnawal speakers. The Canberra, this book here, the research. This book is no longer in publication. You could probably find it in a bookshop. And it talks about a lot of information in there based on historical truth, based on historical records. And for me, it's compelling. And we talk about whether we have the connection to country, whether it's documentation, it's evidence, or whether it's the land itself. For me, it's both. I'd like to combine the two. And for me, it's powerful. It clearly demonstrates my, connection and provenance in the ACT in Canberra. And as I was talking, when I grew up at school, we were told we never existed. We had no connection. So over time, we were able to produce the Tales from Nyambri History, the primary school readers. ACT government actually funded these publications, and they were disseminated throughout all the ACT public schools in the ACT. And basically, they're based on historical truths, Onyong and Noolip. Onyong was the leader of the Nyambri, and Noolip was the leader of the Ngurrumbal, the Ngurrumbal people. And he was also known as Jemmy the Rover, but Onyong's real name was Ali Nyong, and they were both powerful leaders when Europeans first arrived here in the ACT region. Only young leaders in their mid-20s, leading large groups large groups, their family. Goobra, my grandfather, Henry Williams, his Aboriginal name was Goobra. Talking about Nullangbang, Yankee Hat, and we've also got some, you've got to throw in a love story as well, and Kaiwan and Gunji, about the police when they come to country here. So you probably, it's had, here's an image of country out at Cuppacumbalong, out at, on the Murrumbidgee River. I've got lots of images and I've got to update the PowerPoint, but the point I want to make is, you know, there are, the fact of the matter is Aboriginal people all over Australia, all over the world are going to, are fighting over country, competing for their claim to land, and the ACT is no different. The ACT was once a backwater, and my family, we were relatively, there was no competition in terms of country in the 60s. With my mother Matilda here, there was not many Aboriginal people here, but until the early 1970s, the Pan-Aboriginal movement, with the establishment of the Ten Embassy and also the establishment, you know, of federal government and federal departments, a lot of Indigenous people were able to, saw an opportunity to move to Canberra and undertake work here. And slowly over time, there were many different Indigenous Australians here living. And Canberra, yeah, ACT was a backwater. Now it's prestigious. The ACT is prestigious, and a lot of Aboriginal people now are claiming country, want a piece of country here. And that's fine. We don't exclude anyone from the table. Everyone's entitled to sit at the table. But for me, it's important to show your evidence, show your the connection to country. And sure, some people at different levels of understanding and access to information, but government shouldn't deny Aboriginal people that right to research and do their homework and put the evidence on the table. And, you know, I'm all about sharing information, the Ngambri, about sharing information with other people who think they have a claim to country. And a little bit more into that, it's a bit more complex than that. You know, Native Title came in. Aboriginal people, the Native Title Act created a lot of division amongst Aboriginal people in Australia. Native Title and, you know, some kind of economic benefit out of Native Title or from some other means of interaction with government. How long do I? 5 minutes. Yep. So, how do we intend to settle disputes? That's very complex as well. I mean, this question can be asked right around the country, not just here in the ACT. But for me, I'll give you an example of what's happening. Unfortunately, the local ACT government have come out and said who the traditional owners are. I mean, for me, government don't have a right to determine who traditional owners are. It's the people. You can't exclude people from the table or from country by creating legislation or creating policy or protocols that exclude people who have strong connection to country, who have the evidence. To me, that's discrimination. It violates my human rights. What I don't want to see is government institutions like the National Museum or any government institution fall into that trap of dictating to Aboriginal people who they are and where they come from. Leave it up to the Aboriginal people. Leave it up to the mob to decide that and try and find a common ground between the groups and try to resolve that. But don't, for me, big mistake government, especially the ACT government, is stepping in trying to say they're resolving an issue when they're actually making the matter worse. They're making, basically throwing petrol onto the fire in terms of acknowledging people when really they don't have that right to do that. So today, it's my son Reuben a few years ago out on the Gondawarra River with the Cotter River. So, you know, there is a lot of concern about the lack of formal recognition. You know, I talk about acknowledgement. And recognition, you know, I would like to see my children grow up in a society that honours, respects and acknowledges Indigenous people of this country, but government got to be very careful how they do that. And, you know, Indigenous Australians, you know, we're entitled to a greater share in the wealth and prosperity of this country. You know, and for the Ngambri, the Wolgulu speakers from Canberra, you know, we don't own or control any land. We don't hold any senior positions, you know, in federal government or local government. You know, we feel that our voice is not being heard, and that our rights to our country, are being trampled over. So it's a feeling of powerlessness. But you can't take away our connection to country. And we talk about the evidence, and we talk about the land itself. It's still here. So it's powerful for us, and we keep fighting. We've got to get it right for the children, my children, our future children, all the Ngambri children, all children, non-Aboriginal children of Australia. We need to get it right. So I can keep talking about it a bit more. I'm about to be wound up. Any questions? No?
The questions at the end of the panel at the end.
Oh, is there? All right.
Thank you very much, Paul. You know, it takes a lot for Paul to... This is an emotionally engaging subject for Paul, so he's not here talking about other mobs. He's here talking about himself and his mob. So clearly I acknowledge your courage and commitment to doing that and say, yes, I can always recall... I think it was Gary Foley who said, you know, the native title is just... Well, there's two things, he said. And he said, well, he said many things. But he did say a native title is another form of genocide, cultural genocide, because it is run, you know, through governments, and it's the most divisive thing. Now, I don't know what the alternative is, and I haven't got any answers, but I know it is extremely divisive. And the also it's another form of assimilation, according to Gary Foley and Richard Bell, who have a lot of profound things to say. They're radical. So I hope, you know, out of that you're able to get a glimpse into the layers of Aboriginal history that exist in this region. And, of course, the borders were not the political borders that we now see as the ACT borders. Next we have... we keep zoning in and in and in, out from the Indigenous Ngambri country down into this peninsula. Now, I think all of us have a historic connection to this peninsula, either through birthing or death or sickness or a whole range of things. And we have Anne Farris, who's going to take the lens even finer, right down to the medical superintendent's house, where she and other members of the National Centre for Historical Research inhabit. I'm in the right cottage, aren't I? Yeah, inhabit. So she'll be looking at making sense of people's memories through this project, which is centred on the medical superintendent's house, and looking at the layers of memory from pre-European times. So I welcome Anne Farris, who works at the centre, of course, and has been there for just over 2 years now. Welcome, Anne. Who will speak for 20 minutes, because she's a very good girl.
I'd like to tell you about this place on the Acton Peninsula, a site layered with memories, personal and public, intimate and institutional. I spend my working life on this peninsula in a two-storey cream brick house behind a hedge. You would have passed it as you approached the museum earlier today. It's very different from the high-rise city tower where I used to work. Being in the house prompted me to think about the previous occupants and their experiences. Being surrounded by researchers who thought and published motivated me to write. The house was built as a residence for the medical superintendent of the Canberra Hospital, which was opened on this site in 1943. My research project involves finding people who lived in the house and speaking to them about their memories of that time in that place, what it meant to them, how they lived their lives, and how significant the place was in the lives of their family. I hoped to develop an argument that the people who lived in the house contributed in some meaningful and disproportionate way to the Canberra community. It has been hard to draw a boundary around the edge of my work. The house was part of the hospital, and the inhabitants very much so. the hospital was a critical part of the Canberra community. People were born and died there. Fundamental parts of people's lives and that of their family happened here in this very place. As time has gone on, I've realised the undervalued and unrecognised importance of this whole peninsula in terms of the Indigenous connection and contribution to Canberra's early history. Prior to European settlement in about 1824, Indigenous people used the area as an important ceremonial ground. People would gather annually from many areas around to celebrate and discuss differences. It was an area rich in food sources, including fish from the Molongolo River, sheltered from westerly winds, with areas suitable for camping and defending. Europeans were attracted to the area for its source of water and rich farming areas. Slab huts were built after land grants were made, and the land was farmed mainly by tenant farmers. As Paul's referred to, the name of the property Canberry evolved from the name of the Indigenous Ngambri owners. This in turn became Canberra, the name of the national capital. Acton Peninsula was the site of the first formal acquisition of land by the Federal Capital Commission. After being resumed in 1911, it became the administrative centre for the new territory and was the location for a courthouse, a nursery, bank, school, trades hall and post office. It was also the site of a race course, golf course, hockey ground and tourist and camping ground. There were streets of workers' cottages housing young families. The Canberra Community Hospital started here in 1943 and expanded and changed as the population of Canberra grew. Generations of young women left their families and gained independence by living in the nurses' home while completing their hospital training. Originally, the hospital was set on the bend of the river, and then when Lake Burley Griffin was filled, its setting changed to be on a peninsula, surrounded on three sides by a beautiful and long-anticipated lake. In 1991, the hospital was closed after a very long and emotional campaign to save it. In 1997, the main buildings were imploded. A temporary hospice was located here between 1999 until the year 2000. The National Museum of Australia was built here and opened in 2001, and the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies in the same year. So here's a photo taken, I think, in, it says 1961 there, and I'll point out a few of the things I've mentioned to you. There's the string of workers' cottages. This is the hospital here, and the buildings which are still in existence are there. This little thing in between the trees here is the superintendent's house, which you saw in that earlier slide. So the lake sort of makes a line around here. And Lennox Crossing, which was, if you read some of the accounts of early Canberra, Lennox Crossing was quite a feature in the way people lived their lives. You can see there's a lot of land around there. There's the hockey fields and the race course and the golf club all around that area there. Now, this is another slide. It's actually around the other way from the previous one. And again, this is just before the lake was... Well, it's the forming of the lake. So around here is where the lake is going to be, the lake edges. You can see the river along here. We've got Commonwealth Avenue Bridge. And the Hyatt will be in there. And again, there's the house. And that's the peninsula as it is today. And there's the house there. I've lived in Canberra since 1991. Sorry, since 1999. So when I began my research, I asked my neighbour, who was a nurse, who trained at the Canberra Hospital and is a long-term Canberra resident, whether she knew who had lived in the hospital house. We talked more broadly about the hospital, and it didn't take me long to realise that although it was over 15 years since the hospital closed, her memories were still sore. She told me about where she was when the hospital imploded and let me know that neither she nor her family had visited the museum. This response wasn't isolated, and the more I talked to people, the more tiptoeing I felt I had to do. A book was written to collect the memories of nurses and other staff who worked at the hospital. It concludes with a feeling of loss and grief, and was probably written on that basis. My question, is the book a tangible keeper of memories now that the buildings are gone? Do we need something to hold or to see to validate what we have experienced and what we remember? Peter Reed, in his book Return to Nothing, notes that the greater the emotional investment in a site, generally the more painful is the return. I met another lady who got me thinking on this line. She's a long-term resident of this area. She told me that the hospital her children were born in was knocked down, the house they lived in isn't there anymore, and the school her children went to is now used for something else. Again, a sense of loss and displacement. By now, I had reached the stage of contacting people who lived in the house. I was very reticent about writing on museum letterhead. I much preferred to put my home details down. I spoke with a retired doctor who lived in the newly completed house in 1943 with his father, the medical superintendent, his mother and two sisters, as a 12-year-old. I asked him about his memories of living there. We walked around the house and he recalled cleaning ashes from the fireplace and his mother planting bulbs in the garden. He told me about the dinners that his mother used to host for the American doctors. The United States Army Medical Corps were based in Canberra for a short period before relocating to Queensland to be near their patients. One of his memories was particularly striking. An American colonel in full dress uniform sat down to dine with the boy's family. The colonel, who smoked a cigar and chewed gum at the same time, stubbed out the cigar on one fork and placed the gum on another before starting his meal. I could imagine a scene like that sticking in the mind of a 12-year-old boy. I had done some reading about the occupation of the hospital by the Americans, and when I checked the dates, it didn't look like the family was in the house when the Americans were in town. This got me thinking. I believe the event really happened. It was so vivid in his memory 65 years or so after the event. Did it happen in another house? Did the colonel come back later for a visit? This was my introduction to the complex relationship between memory and fact. I spoke to other people who had lived in the house as children. One woman in particular had delightful memories of the house, the garden, and the surrounding areas. Her mother preserved fruit from the garden and made jams. She and her siblings swam, sailed, and canoed on and in the lake, going to the island nearby. They did this at night too, and she recalled following the track of the moon along the water in her boat. They had a special tree in the garden, which they called their dreaming tree. They had parties for the hospital staff in the summer under the tree. This beautiful oak tree is still there. It reminds me of the children's book, My Place, written by Nadia Wheatley and illustrated by Donna Rawlins, where a particular tree is the centre of focus for memory of generations of children before European settlement until 1988. The landscape and environment change over time, but the tree remains. Older Canberra women have memories of the pregnant pine, a pine tree with a bulge on the side, again a tree which remains on the site. It was located, quite appropriately, outside the maternity ward. Recently, the ACT National Trust commissioned a survey of the social value of Lake Burley Griffin and its surrounds. The latest Heritage in Trust report identifies special memories as an important reason for people aged 12 to 24 born in the ACT visiting the lake. It notes, These results suggest that an attachment to place is only just starting to form in the ACT, given the importance of memory in creating a sense of place. Unveiling a commemorative site on Acton Peninsula in 2006, 15 years after the closure of the hospital, our Chief Minister, John Stanhope, said, "It was rare to find a Canberra family that did not harbour some abiding memories of the Royal Canberra Hospital, including the birth of babies and the loss of loved ones." An elderly gentleman came here each year to remember the passing of his wife. He bought a chair, some champagne, and two glasses, and sat in a space that he shared with his wife before she died. This is one way he remembers her. There are other formal memories on this site if you look hard enough. The Bogong moths, the Goree sculptures, help us acknowledge and remember the ownership and use of this land by Indigenous people. This black granite monument brings to mind the people who lived and worked here between 1911 and 1964. The commemorative site at the end of the peninsula, Hospital Point, recalls the people who contributed a variety of skills and services and part of their life to the Royal Canberra Hospital. It is made up of stones from the first house on the site. These stones had also been used in a fountain outside the entrance to the hospital and the foundation stone of the hospital. So this reads, on this site, Lieutenant J.J. Moore, the first settler in this district, built his residence. Now the museum is located on the site. The museum sets out to reveal the stories of ordinary and extraordinary Australians, to facilitate an exploration of knowledge and ideas, and to provide a forum for discussion and reflection. I've seen visitors in the galleries looking at objects and heard them recalling parts of their own past and sharing that with their families. Daily, families, school children and adults come here recalling memories and creating memories. A woman who completed an internship in mid-2008 at the museum had a previous career as a nurse on this site. During her internship, she worked in a space where she had once cradled premature babies. Being on a site in the space re-immersed her in a wave of memories and emotions. Unprompted, she made the connection between her work as a nurse, bringing children into the world, and caring for the sick and dying as a search for meaning. She found it particularly apt that the museum is on a site full of meaning. And Paul House, who we have heard from, reflects this too. He writes, "It seems to have come full circle that Acton was once the site of peoples gathering to celebrate, express and share cultures. And through the museum, it is again a site which brings together nations of people to do the same thing." Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Farris. It's quite a great combo, the two Paul House's and Anne's, the black and white sort of Indigenous history, even though each refer to the other. And now we're going to have a few words from Leanne Dempsey, who we all know because she's put together this fantastic forum which has kept the time all day and everyone's been very well behaved, and lots of questions are asked and there'll be more to do at the end. You've got a good, and I think Peter Stanley has like half an hour to close, so I hope he has a few tricks up his sleeve. Leanne is currently works in audience development and public programs here at the museum. Obviously, intercultural heritage management, has a bachelor degree and master of sustainable heritage, so she's a really serious heritage girl. She's currently doing a PhD in museum studies at UQ, and what I found interesting about what she's looking at is what she calls live exhibits and sort of non-live, inspirited places. So the thing that grabbed my attention was, you know, the inhabitation of spirits, ancestors or ghosts in the as an intangible form of culture and intangible heritage. And, of course, a museum is definitely a multi-layered site for the various forms of life that exist in things that are supposedly not live, and particularly in Indigenous area, for me at least, but I certainly know the spirits and dimensions and experiences of others are embodied in so-called inanimate objects. So I think she could do a much better job of this than I can. So I'd like to hand over to Leanne Dempsey to talk about the National Museum's permanent residence and tales within. Thank you, Leanne.
Well, hello yet again. I'll just get my slides up. This is the part of the day where I hope everyone's not too exhausted and prepared to hear a few stories. So if you are a sceptic, just try and suspend that sense of disbelief for a short time. Paul's reminded us that we are here on Indigenous land now, so I'd like to start by acknowledging with great respect the spirits and the ancestors of this place who occupy this place and the people who belong to this place. I'd also like to acknowledge the people who have been born and died on this place, one of whom, my husband, was actually born in the Royal Canberra Hospital, so this is a place of significance to him and also to me by extension. So what is an inspirited site? What am I talking about? Inspirited places are places basically that are believed by people to actually be occupied by personages of the spiritual persuasion. So ancestors, what we might call ghosts, spirits of place, what my parents might call fairies. And they exist all over the place. They exist all over Australia. They exist all over the world. They very much exist inside of us. And I believe that they're an important part of this nation's intangible heritage. What do I mean by that? Think about that feeling that you get when you go into, say, a place like our Australian War Memorial, into the Hall of Memories with the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Lots of people very, very moved in a place like that. My father once went to a place called Culloden, which was a battle had taken place there a very, very long time before. My father, who is of the sceptical persuasion, was very moved by that place as well and hasn't let me forget it. Think of, for persons of Australian background here who might have heard of the story of Fisher's Ghost. It's a fairly early sort of post-invasion story from Campbelltown in New South Wales. There is now a Campbelltown festival that goes by the same name, Fisher's Ghost Festival, where people get together to celebrate this story, which, if you think about it, has a bit of everything that you could possibly want: morality, mateship, murder, courtroom drama, and, of course, a ghost. And, of course, I occasionally refer to the Port Arthur Historic Site in Tasmania, where I'm actually going on holidays fairly soon, and many people think the Port Arthur Historic Site. They also think about the well-known ghost tours there. So whether or not you are actually a believer, and I'm not going to ask you that question, it's entirely up to you. Whether or not you do believe in these things, it's very difficult to deny the volume of the heritage that exists in Australia and around the world. And it's also not really possible to deny the value that those stories have to many, many, many of us. An inspirited site is a site that takes the concept of memory just that one step further. Nothing can remind you of the nature, the function, the history, and the memories of a place more than encountering it as it floats through the wall towards you. Even being aware of these stories when you actually walk into a place or feel that indefinable sense of otherness that can come in some places, that can be enough to focus in your mind the intangible heritage of the place you're walking into. So this place we're sitting in right now is an inspirited site. Many museums and galleries in the world are, for some reason. Perhaps because they house collections and objects that are emotional, spiritual, or very evocative. Maybe because they're quite often built in places of significance. And maybe it's simply because they're the sort of places where people will slow down and have a think about themselves, about the place they're in, take the time to acknowledge the fact that they're walking through a place of memory or a place of history. So I'm going to tell you about a few of our permanent residents who remind us that there is more to a museum than its exhibitions. But to begin with, I was thrilled that in the last couple of weeks some of the silly news sites that I like to trawl online came up with stories such as this one that's up on the screen at the moment. So I've got two recent stories that have been published in newspapers for you to enjoy. This is actually one from the National Civil War Naval Museum at Columbus in Alabama in the US. It's got a bit of trouble, having a bit of trouble with flying books in its gift shop. And I'm happy to say that if we get out of here in time and you want to go to our gift shop, that's unlikely to happen to you here. This article doesn't say much about the building's history, and it doesn't say much about why staff or visitors speculate that the books might be getting moved. I went and had a look at the website of the place itself, and very little was said about the history of the building. The article here and the website both mention, however, that the museum's response to this happening was to get in a team of ghost hunters with various forms of electronic equipment to find out whatever it is that they can find out. I have actually done a bit of ghost hunting myself. It's tremendous fun for about the first hour, and I haven't actually seen anything much more than a fair amount of Milo, but I don't mean to be very unpleasant and sceptical about it. It can actually be a very enjoyable thing to do. However, I must say, in terms of understanding the deeper meaning of why these books are leaping off the shelf and attacking innocent shoppers, I can't imagine what they'll contribute. So this is a mystery that doesn't look as though it's likely to be solved anytime soon. Here's a little example closer to home. New South Wales Parliament, isn't that great? The New South Wales Parliament has its own permanent residence. They're a bit less assertive than the ones in Alabama, and in fact, they're much more like our own in their character. So this is an article from the Daily Telegraph. It reveals that New South Wales Parliament House and Government House both have permanent residents that remind staff about the histories and the memories of the buildings that they work in. They have vague, unexpected noises and shadowy figures. These are... I've done a bit of research. These are alarmingly common symptoms. But they do help to tell part of the story of the site, and these are stories, think about it, that might otherwise be forgotten in the business of government. When one is busy doing one's work, one isn't always thinking about things that may have happened in the same place before one. And sometimes I think that can be a valuable thing. So the response here, rather than open the buildings to ghost hunters with electronic equipment to measure EMF, is to produce an educational bulletin which will interpret the site for visitors. And I'm actually looking forward to that. It hasn't been written yet. I went and had a look. So there's two stories. Now I'd like to tell you one of my own. On your left is actually a page from our staff newsletter, The Loop, from May 2006. Telling this story that relates to this beautiful blue dress, which is used to be on display in our old Horizons Gallery just out the door here and is now back in storage as far as I know. One of our security guards who works here, we have lovely security guards here. This person hadn't been to the Horizons Gallery for a while, came back and reported to the security control room that he liked the new dress on show in Horizons and that it looked particularly good on the lifelike blonde mannequin. As you can see from the photos here, this is how the dress was actually displayed, which sent the guard scurrying up with a torch to take a second look. I know that the guard left the museum shortly afterwards, but I don't actually know whether that has anything to do with this experience. Another story. This is my story relating to this dress. I have worked here in the past as a host, interpreting the building and collections for visitors. One afternoon, a few years ago, I was in the Horizons Gallery trying fruitlessly to interest a group of teenage children, a class actually, in the Springfield collection of objects that was on display. Now, this dress is from the Springfield collection. It was a collection belonging to a family from New South Wales over quite a period of time. The teenagers, I don't know if anyone has teenage kids, they were very tired. They'd been at it all day. They were quite fed up. They didn't really want to be there. They'd actually been herded there by their teacher, I saw, who said, go and learn something. And the poor things were just quite keen to leave and go home. So in desperation, I suggested to a couple of the kids that they might like to hear a little bit more about the haunted dress. Immediately, I was surrounded by a mob of avid teenagers, all keen to hear the adventures of the security guard. And after I told the story, they all started firing questions at me. At first, they were all about the dress and the spirit who apparently came for a visit. Then the questions became more broad. The students wanted to know about the family involved, how the dress was made, who it might have been worn by. Was it expensive? Where did it come from? How did it end up on display at the museum? They were fascinated by whatever emotional link was so strong that it apparently attracted a spirit to actually make a visit to an object standing in a glass display case in a museum. The next thing I knew, they were all asking questions about the social history of the family who lived in Springfield from 1888 onwards, and that was really spooky. I'm going to tell you a few more stories now, because it's towards the end of the day and I'm sure we're all tired. This is for you to enjoy as you walk through the galleries afterwards. This is the story of our celebrity spirit, for want of a better term. This corridor here we refer to as Upper Nation, and it stretches between the children's cubby house area and the entrance to the Gallery of First Australians. And it features, as you can see, a series of glass cases over here in which we have objects on display that illustrate snapshots from Australian history. It's also one part of the museum where staff and occasionally visitors have reported seeing a nursing sister. Now, we call her nursing sister because she's been seen by one or two people clearly enough that they've had a bit of a look at what she seems to be wearing. So she seems to be related, of course, to the former Royal Canberra Hospital. Although I should note that she walks the corridors that are the museum's corridors, and not the old routes that she probably did tread in the old building, which I find very interesting. Along this corridor and in another couple of parts of the building, she's been seen as a reflection in the glass display cases here, so only in reflection. When the viewer turned around, of course, there was nobody there, which is traditional in these cases, I believe. Other times she has been seen with the naked eye, in the corridor that is in this picture and in other parts of the building. And in fact, I know there's some staff members in the audience here. You may or may not be interested in the fact that she has been seen in the admin wing where many of us work. Our nursing sister has been blamed for occasional misdemeanours. I don't know whether this is fair, such as invisibly grabbing at people's clothes and touching people's faces and hands. She has genuinely frightened a couple of people that I've spoken to, including visitors who once came and asked me when I was a host if there was a costume thing on, because they'd seen her and weren't entirely sure whether she seemed quite right, which was very interesting for me because up until that stage I wasn't sure if I really believed in her, which is a terrible thing to say. We don't have a name yet for her, but at this stage, I want to make it clear that I am aware we are talking about potentially a real person who lived and worked on this site. She may have been someone's mum or grandmum. She undoubtedly had friends and family who may be with us today, may even be among us in the audience. So she deserves our respect for this reason alone. However, she is evidently quite a sensitive spirit. If people don't speak well of her, she has been known to object by causing sudden, extremely loud noises and really giving people a terrible fright. I myself am sure that she was a wonderful person and completely beyond reproach. A lot of wonderful people were born and passed away in this place. And I'm glad, personally, that we have this occasional reminder of this one time in our site's history when these facts of life were an everyday occurrence. It helps to cement in my mind why it is that I work here. Personally, I'd very much like to meet our nursing sister sometime, although I don't know whether I personally have that ability. That's something I wonder about. This lovely, dark and spooky place is called Open Collections. It's on the lower floor of our Gallery of First Australians. It's a sort of combined storage and display room for a large number of extremely beautiful Indigenous objects from all over Australia. Many of the objects are light sensitive, so it's only open for 15 minutes on the hour between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. daily, so you have to come back another day to have a look. It's worth it. A lot of people are very much overwhelmed by the beauty of the objects. And other people who enter the room are overwhelmed by something else. So staff and visitors alike, again, who I've spoken to, have reacted very strongly to this room, which is admittedly dark and quiet. Reactions are very emotional. Some people find it unpleasant and threatening and won't go in. Other people find it peaceful and welcoming, and I know of at least one staff member it can be very difficult to extract from the room when he's in there. He really finds it very welcoming. Many people report a sense of being observed, although I'm not sure how notable that is in a building that is bristling with security cameras. I personally have seen people refuse to step into the room, and people who've burst into tears when they walk into the room, although, as I've said, the emotional impact of such a large number of beautiful and varied objects is hard to go past. There are theories I've spoken to about the reasons for the reactions, and these theories vary. In all honesty, we don't know whether this is something that comes from the collections themselves, the room itself, or memories that are associated with the room that may or may not actually be accurate memories. Somebody once suggested to me that there might have been a hospital morgue in the vicinity. I'm not too convinced about that one. I haven't seen any evidence of it. There is actually an ex-morgue somewhere on the site, and we store books and manuscripts in it. But the emotional punch that is packed by this room does turn people's minds to something important. And when I ask people why they react strongly to this room, a lot of people have speculated that perhaps it's because the objects in the room are so imbued with spirit. And this isn't always said by Indigenous people. So that that implies that connection between spirit and object that's so prevalent in Indigenous society is beginning to be recognised elsewhere. Why am I showing you a picture here of some rather smudgy elevator doors? It's actually the inside and outside of the same elevator. Certain of our security guards, lovely people, are not too keen on this particular lift. Outside of opening hours, and not necessarily within opening hours, it seems to be the focus of some childlike pranks played by permanent residents on staff. Specifically, the ringing of the alarm and the unexpected stopping of the lift between floors, trapping our security guards therein, and accompanied by the sound of childish laughter from outside, which is very alarming at 3 a.m. Although I'm sure all our security staff are experts in jiu-jitsu and not easily frightened. So we're getting close. I'm charging through, but I think we are getting close to the end of this anyway. 3.5 minutes. This is a small selection of stories, and I won't tell you too many more, but we do have other stories. I myself have had an experience in the annex, which is another older building which is on this site. When I was working outside of ours, I felt a very distinct tap on the shoulder, assuming it was a friendly security guard letting me know that they were aware of my presence there after hours. I turned around and, of course, there was nobody there. Speaking to other people who work in that building, this isn't an isolated incident. Again, I was very surprised. I waited to feel frightened but couldn't. It felt too much like a friendly tap on the shoulder to be alarming. Some stories that I could tell you and won't relate clearly to objects in the collection, such as the Springfield dress, that blue dress that I showed you. Some relate to previous layers in the site's history, such as our nursing sister and one or two others. Others, such as open collections or our mysterious elevator pranksters, are open to interpretation. We don't know what is behind them. They range from outright frightening, and some are very scary stories that I've been told and won't share here because they're a bit sad. Some are sweet and comforting, such as my tap on the shoulder, and some are frankly baffling. I couldn't resist sticking this photo in. What do you see when you allow yourself to perceive the veil that separates the everyday National Museum of Australia from the spirits that exist here, either in legend or in reality? Does the veil between us and the spirit world obfuscate that view? Do the stories and experiences surrounding these spirits distract us from our purpose of exploring land, nation and people of Australia in this building, or does it actually let a little bit more information come through? I often ask myself, when I speak to somebody who summarily dismisses a tale of spirits, ancestors or ghosts, whether they might be the ones who are missing a valuable point. Our permanent residence can be either perceived or very real reminders of memories that could otherwise be lost, histories that might be forgotten, connections with people in the past and in the present, connections with this locality and this site that we love so much, and a connection with the wider community. So I'm going to leave it here and pass back over to Margot. And if you've ever had any experiences here that you're willing to share, please let me know, because I'm always willing to listen. Thank you.
That's before mind-altering substances, that is. From an Indigenous perspective, of course, the spirit world is perfectly as real as the so-called historical world that, I have to say, doesn't often take into account enough of that other form of experience. So your example of how to get rowdy teenagers involved in objects is something I think the museum could learn from. They get far too intense about the historic reality, historic proof. So we can probably lighten up a little on that one. Now, I think what we're going to do is ask Leanne, Paul and Anne if they wouldn't mind occupying these seats if they're not already occupied by those other beings that we're talking about. So if you wouldn't mind coming up, and we have, I was told I could, go over a little earlier to save Peter having too long on his hands. Help you out. Now, obviously, it's the same rigmarole as normal. You've heard three very stimulating, very different, but very complementary presentations on the sites of significance, the layering of sites. So it's now open to you for your challenging questions and comments. And whose hand's up first? There's always a good Samaritan in every room. There you go. Found him. Down there.
My question's to you, Paul. I know reconnecting to country, in that process, it's important to collect stories from the old people. Have you been able to do that?
Absolutely. That's a lot of the evidence I talk about is written evidence, but there's also the oral stories that come through the family. And talking to my mother and my grandparents and my great grandparents, uncles and aunties, that's where a lot of the stories come from. And they're very important, that oral history.
And they weren't difficult for you to get then?
Oh, look, there's a lot of stories out there. Like the story about the hairy man, the Doolagar Aguba and the hairy man at Yankee Hat. It's about Australians know that the hairy man is the Yowie, but we call him the Doolagar, and he's the hairy man that lives out in the mountains in country. And there's a story in the Queanbeyan Age about how my great-great-grandfather witnessed some of his elders burying a hairy man, and it's actually recorded in the Queanbeyan Age, and we based one of those stories in the Tales from Yambri history on those ethno-historical records, and we bring them together also with the oral stories passed through the family. Yep, thank you.
A couple over. Oh. Paul, Barbara.
Okay, my question's to Paul.
Identify yourself, I forgot to ask.
Okay, my name's Barbara Paulson, I'm here at the museum. My question is to Paul, and it is regarding the controversial statement made a couple of weeks ago and how that statement impacted you on how you express your identity, because one of the things in terms of sites of memory, I think we were talking earlier about how important memory and nationalism was, and how that impacts upon how we express ourselves, you know, as people, as individuals, and as a collective. So how does the statement that was made by the ACT government affect you personally and in your family when they talk about Ngunnawal and Ngambri?
Yeah, good question. This is stuff that concerns the family, concerns a lot of people, our people, and non-Aboriginal people in the ACT and around the country. I'm not quite sure whether you're familiar with the politics in the ACT. Unfortunately, the ACT government has come out and made a decision on who the traditional owners are, and for us, they don't have a right to do that. It's a process of exclusion, and unfortunately, they develop protocols and piece of legislation that excludes one group in terms of their connection to country. And all the evidence I shared with you today, that evidence is powerful, compelling, based on the historical truth. Unfortunately, the ACT government ignore all that and simply just put it aside and say, we don't exist and we won't acknowledge you any. We don't acknowledge you. So that's pretty disappointing for me, because in a way it's a form of modern-day genocide through, you know, stealth policy and legislation. It's covert. It's both covert and overt. Very disappointing, and to me it's un-Australian, and I just think it's setting a dangerous precedent around the country, around the world, in terms of how government relate with Indigenous people, with all people. I think we're all entitled to be acknowledged, everyone, not just Aboriginal people. We're all entitled. But when you have the evidence that connects you and demonstrates your provenance to the country, it's disappointing. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, I hope the federal government doesn't, you know, think that they think they've got a right to do this kind of thing around the country. Otherwise, I think you're going to see turmoil out there in the communities. There's already enough turmoil without government sort of making these kind of decisions and dividing Aboriginal people further apart between each other and apart from non-Indigenous people. So, I don't know, they call it democracy. I spoke about that earlier on. And, look, I don't think it's fair, you know. The practical side of it is that I actually can't go into a public school where my children go to and provide a welcome to country on the land I was born, because I don't conform with the ACT government's policy that I'm not a Ngunnawal person. Unfortunately, John doesn't understand that the word Ngunnawal is a linguistic term that describes the Wallabalawa people. He simply doesn't ignores history, he ignores the evidence. I don't know why. He may feel threatened by Indigenous people with demonstrated bona fides to country connection. I'm not quite sure. I don't know what his motive is. I don't think it's a consensus within the ACT government in terms of why he made that decision. I think there's surely the opposition, the Greens and other members of the Labor Party would not support what he's doing. And I think it's an outrage. I think it's, you know, it's discriminatory. And unfortunately, yesterday, the Social Justice Commissioner for Australia, for Indigenous Australia, Tom Calmer, actually went and acknowledged the ACT government's protocols and disallowed my mother to do a welcome to country at the press club yesterday. And he's the Social Justice Commissioner in this country. So this is the kind of things that's happening right here and right now, right in front of our faces. I think it's, you know, disgusting. So, but, you know, we've got to keep fighting for country, sharing our stories, you know. It's disappointing, you know. I can, you know, demonstrate my connection to country right back to Europeans arrived on the horizon, and I'm told I don't come from here. What am I missing? I'm not quite sure. And I acknowledge the National Museum of Australia. They've got a tough challenge. All government departments have got a tough challenge. I've spoken to many federal ministers about what the ACT government have done, and a lot of the ministers, you know, agree and support and just can't believe what's happening, but they need to back it up a bit more as well. But, you know, a lot of good people out there, you know, just we have the support, which is good. It's not about excluding anyone. Everyone's entitled to, you know, lay a claim to country. But let's do it with mutual respect. let's do it, you know, in partnership. Let's do it in, you know, a way that we can all find common ground and try and move forward. But at the moment, it's might over right, the might of government, the power of government over the right of Aboriginal people and their connection to country. It's not easy. But we've got to keep fighting. You know, that's why, the story is about survival, the struggle for survival in this country. And, you know, it's good to, you know, share the story. And you know, I've been around a little bit of time and I've met a lot of people, and everywhere I go, it's all about sharing and sharing the historical truths with everyone. Anne's story, you know, when J.J. Moore first arrived here, early in 1820s, he asked our ancestors, what do you call this place? And they didn't say the barbecue area. They said Nyambri, Canberra, many different renditions, you know, and then it was Romanised, Anglicised, and we have Canberra today. And unfortunately, ACT government ignore that evidence and don't seem to be proud and take that on into, you know, their policy or legislation or just into their procedures. Unfortunately, we're excluded, and it's a national shame. You know, and unfortunately, we don't see any recognition here really at all in the National Museum in terms of country of ancestors. It's unhealthy. I think it's unhealthy. I think we've all got to sit down and seriously put our heads together and move forward on this. Unfinished business, but I could talk more about it, but, yeah, I'll share that.
You'd be around a little bit after if people want to... You pinging off at 4:30 or are you going to hang in a bit here? If Paul's still around, then I'm sure others would like to have a chat. I appreciate you acknowledging how difficult it is for places like the National Museum of Australia, who, as you referred to earlier, is not the policeman of who is and who isn't traditional owners of this place. So it is, and I appreciate the fact that you said that, because I think a lot of people in the community don't realise that a lot of institutions... mainstream institutions want to do the right thing all the time. They get very confused by the politics, and as Paul also suggested, the resolution of those politics reside within the community where they've arisen. again, there's lots of other things to go with it. I have a question, but I won't ask until the next person. Yes, here's one up here.
Anne? Is that working? That was a superb presentation. You showed how memories have been revived, places have been reclaimed through different means. There was a piece of black granite, there were monuments in the ground, there was a forum for sharing stories. But you showed photographs of the peninsula at three intervals. The first two were quite fascinating, and then the third one was an absolute transformation. So I recalled what Paul had to say about the land is still here. I've lived here all my life, 70 years. But a lot of Canberra, for me, is at risk, because up on the hill, for example, old Canberra House, transformed, and yet... If only the walls could speak of old Canberra House, they could relate that Walter... incidentally, I'm chair of the Walter Burley Griffin Society.
Oh, good.
And Walter Burley Griffin, when he arrived in Canberra in the Limestone Plains, the first visit, stayed there. And many were the discussions he had when he was a guest of the commissioner, and they differed on practically everything. Been very interesting discussions, given the different personalities. So the question arises, although you pointed out very well how you can revive and reclaim and remember, you do have to keep buildings. An old Canberra House is a classic example. To have lost old Canberra House is a grievous, I guess, after old Parliament House, there's more of our Canberra. European heritage, let's say, in that site, the landscape as well as the building, but the hubris of a university wanting to make its impact, and as a graduate of the university, I'm all in favour of the university doing precisely that. But it underlines the importance of values, of social assessments, of oral histories and other evidence which can support heritage, can support the listing of heritage and indeed the preservation of buildings of the importance of Old Canberra House. This is just a commentary of the present state of play in this town.
I think that's right, and I think it relates back to a bit of what about Peter said about, you know, if you understand it, then it becomes special and then you treasure it. And I suppose from, you know, my variety of views, you know, being sort of new to Canberra, being new to this sort of area of research, that the more people understand and value things, the better it's going to be. And the things that worry me are about, you know, beautiful buildings, for example, that aren't being used at the moment. It's kind of like the path they've had, there's a gap, and what happens then? And the place, you know, I wonder about the Albert Hall, for example. You know, stories that I've read are, again, you know, it was a really big part of a lot of people's early history. You know, they met their partners and all these wonderful things happened there. But people who are coming into Canberra now just sort of see it, I think, as an old building that, you know, holds fair, I was going to say fur sales, but not fur sales, you know, leather sales. And I think that's really sad. And there's a whole lot of conflicts there. And that's not the only one. I mean, there's other heritage issues that are coming up now with the bus depot and the bus driver's house in Ainslie, which I sort of pricked my ears up to find out about then. You know, all these buildings have had really interesting things happen in them, but we need to be able to understand that and to appreciate it and to value it. And, you know, one of my things, I think, too, is that Canberra doesn't... Well, this is what... Personally, I think Canberra undervalues its history, and a lot of it focuses on the, you know, the establishment of the national capital, but what happened before that and what happens after it has kind of faded, and I don't think that's good enough, really.
I'll just intervene just quickly there. I have to, you know, while you're talking about how people are grieving the loss of a house or a school or something, I have to say, as an Indigenous person, the thing I found most grief-stricken in your images, in the name of progress, was the whole ravaging of the land. That it was just, I don't know about you, Mob, whether it's just me or what, but I just couldn't believe it. It's such a, I don't know, such a, you know, Western thing to do, is to just totally rearrange a geography for some really current contemporary purpose, because people are doing it only in their lifetime. And I just thought, I was horrified. I mean, I knew, you know, I've seen pictures, but not quite like that. That was extraordinary. And that's just my grief and looking at that. And I'm not even from here like this, Mob, so imagine how that is. There's a lady at the back, and I have to...
Right, just a question for Leanne. Thank you for your talk. It was really enjoyable. How do you feel about, like Tim the Yowie Man that does ghost tours of Canberra? I mean, is he aware of the things that are happening here? Have you been on those tours? Do you see that as a hook to get people interested in history, just like you got those very tired teenage students interested in the dress?
From my own perspective, I'm a ghost tour addict, and yes, I've certainly been on Tim's, and I must say I've been on quite a few in Australia and overseas, and come to the conclusion that there are basically two kinds of ghost tours. There's the type that Tim actually does do very well, which is to link the social history of a site, and sometimes the less known history of a site, to those stories as a form of hot interpretation. While you're having quite an entertaining time and getting a few chills, you're also learning quite a lot and absorbing quite a lot and remembering a lot. Then there's the type where, that there seems to be more focus on entertainment. And while I will enjoy those kind of tours very much, I mean, obviously I'm coming from a heritage perspective,
so I don't see as much value in them. But yes, Tim does know a little bit about this site. He's actually been onto this site. We've gone through it together, and he's actually told me a few stories that he has heard from other people. So Tim's quite a good social historian. He does a lot of his own background research as well. So, you know, I think when it's in good hands like that, it can be a really valuable opportunity for interpretation. Bearing in mind, of course, that we're quite often talking about sensitive issues. We're talking about ancestors or spirits of place, things that are important to people. So there's always the caveat that the spirits probably are worthy of respect. I like a little bit of humour myself, don't we all? But yeah, that's always the underlying thing, that we're talking about people's ancestors and we're talking about spirits that represent a place, and so we mustn't ever forget that.
Barbara. And then probably one more, unless Peter chooses this session to go longer. If the call's yours.
This question goes to Anne. This morning Peter was talking about the value of memory and placing it onto a site, and then you sort of talked before about the memory that went into a book, and so therefore you sort of transferred or implied transferring of that memory and importance held to a site that was then demolished, moved on to something else, and all the emotions that went with that site went into that book. And so the memory or the importance of that memory is associated with that book. Can you sort of expand a bit more on how it was with, because, you know, when we talk about memory, we are talking about people and people's experience and the way they feel emotionally about their history. So the translation or the transference from sight to a book, a movable object.
I think this is, these are the questions that I'm raising, and the book that I'm talking about is called The Canberra Hospital, An Anecdotal History of Nursing. And so my understanding of how the book was written was when they knew the hospital was going to be demolished, two women who were nurses got together, they spoke to as many people as they could about their experiences of working and living here, and they put it together as a book. And so that was published. Now, I wouldn't say that the emotions from that were transferred from the site to the book, because obviously they're the people that I've come across who have contributed to the book still very firmly have connections to this place, you know, so strongly that they will not come here. It's not like a direct transfer, it's sort of like taking it out of here and put it in the book. But I just wonder whether, you know, that book that would sit on the shelves of people who had lived and worked and nursed here gives them a sense of resolution, a sense of, you know, it was just horrible, but this is my book and this is part of my story, and it is valid, even if the building that I worked in and spent my life in is no longer there.
One down here.
This isn't exactly a question.
Wait one moment, madame. Do I have the...
This isn't exactly a question, but if there's an implicit question there, it would be addressed to Anne, I think. We talk now about preserving buildings, say, 60, 70 years old. Is consideration ever given to the thing that when the situation that when those buildings were built, they are a violation of somebody else's memories? How does that fit in?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that I was reading a report. It was a newspaper report on the opening of the building by the architect Leighton Irwin, and he designed a lot of hospitals around, particularly country New South Wales. And he said, you know, this hospital is designed to last for 40 years. And if you add the years up, you know, it's when it went. It was close to when he had anticipated it to go.
That wasn't quite my question. My question is, when those buildings were built, they were also violations. Mm. And why are we now sort of pressing for their retention when they were violations of somebody else's memories, say Paul's family's memories?
Yeah. Well, that's right. And the other example of that on this site, which I didn't talk about, was when Acton House was pulled down, and that was one of the early settlers' houses, and there was no fuss when that was built
was pulled down. But you're right, that was, you know, that was on top of Indigenous land, and the hospital was on top of that, and the museum was on top of that. I can't answer. Yeah,
it's called archaeology. You just take a big core, you know, right through all the buildings and put in the museum. Probably, let me see. You're the boss lady there, Leanne. How long does Mr. Stanley need for closing?
As long as Mr. Stanley wants.
See? 15? Okay, I think if there's one more pressing question or comment, we will have it. There is one, and then that's it. It's like I feel like an auctioneer. Over there. One. Is that right? Is there a question over there? No. Okay. Oh, Mum, sorry, I wasn't looking below the snow line. Oh, sorry.
just two comments. The book you're talking about was launched at Albert Hall, which is where the nurses used to go dancing. And at the launch, we discussed about the whole relationships that were there in Canberra, the social life. I think it's more than the building. It's about the whole relationships and the placemaking. The second thing is, and I can say this with historical authority, I was the chair after self-government that was asked by Rosemary Follett and Bill Wood, with the assistance of Lynnett Crocker, an Aboriginal woman, to bring, you know, to bring all the Aboriginal families with a stake in the casino premium money, $3 million that was allocated, to discuss how to come together and deal with it. So 28 Indigenous leaders, Indigenous people, we spent a whole day at O'Connell Educational Centre, right? I was facilitating, Lynnett Crocker was assisting me, Matilda House was there, you know, Williams, you know, sort of, everybody was there, you know, all the people. What was agreed was that what is called ACT is a construct, right? It's an administrative construct, you know, a construct that Canberrans didn't want and it was dumped on them, that it was inappropriate and it would be silly for Indigenous people to disagree with each other. Everybody came to a consensus, like Paul said, you know, that there's enough room for everyone. You know, colonialism has done a good job of diminishing the numbers so much. There were such small numbers, there was enough room for everyone. And everybody agreed, let's all work together, not tread on each other's toes. Don't let the government divide us and rule. I mean, that was the agreement, and that was the agreement that I took to the Chief Minister, right? But what I found amazing was, at that time in the ACT government, there was one bureaucrat, one-third for Indigenous Affairs, one-third, this is Lisa Foreman, one-third for Multicultural Affairs, one-third for Disability Services. This is how we started ACT self-government. They have not been able to deal with it. They have not been able to, when Indigenous people here, there were four, I mean, I can say that, and Paul, actually, you were a student, I think, at that stage, so, you know, so, and four different groups that had differences of opinion, but they all agreed to work together because they believed that in an artificial construct that's very much imposed, in fact, the word that they used was neocolonial, that Aboriginal people should not argue with each other when their own boundaries were, you know, seamless or porous, you know, sort of in the way relationships were articulated. So I am absolutely disappointed that that consensus that was reached and people have been trying to work with. I'm now an alien here. I've moved out of Canberra. But it's really heartbreaking to hear. You know, we pay a lot of lip service nationally to Indigenous people all the time. But when Indigenous people actually come together to move forward, we don't know how to cope with it. Our governments don't know how to cope with it. And I still remember Pat Dodson saying to some of the members of the group, he said, look, you know, our history is so fragmented because of displacement and colonialism. This is Indigenous people he was talking about. You know, that, you know, we have to learn to bear with each other our differences and try to work together, because he's very eloquent the way he shows that Otherwise, the way colonialism has fragmented us, you know, we let that divide and rule mentality continue in this country. And that was the spirit with which everybody agreed to work together. And I'm so sorry that, you know, yes, this morning people were talking about amnesia, and you were talking about distortion of memory. It seems, you know, it's not all that long ago. Why can't governments remember? Anyway, I just wanted to say.
Okay, that's an appropriate place to stop. Thank you, Amar. And while Mr. Stanley's making his way to the front. No, you have to do the close. It says here. Oh, Mr. Oh, well, Doctor. I'm so sorry. Oh, my humble apology. Thank you very much to the panel. And my parting sentence will be, you know, memory is predicated on forgetting.
Thank you. Good. Okay. You have to take a stand, Margot. Right. Or I won't mention your conference, all right? Well, hello. Thank you for your attention and participation in today. While papers have been delivered, I've been sitting there making some notes, hence the laptop. Leanne, this has been a very cleverly constructed program, much more sophisticated than I first assumed. We saw many connections between papers through the day, and it certainly reinforced my conviction that conferences like this are worthwhile, but that we always need more time to confer, so we'll learn from that lesson, I hope. Let me summarise some reflections on today, where it's led and where it might lead us. First of all, we opened with Amar Galla's insights based on a very extensive relationship, professional relationship with memory and engagement with heritage over many years, in which he talked about the relationship between personal and collective memories. And I think that's been the first of the many themes that's run through the day. And Amar introduced us to the idea of residual memories and suggested it was our job to sift through those layers of cultural memory. And his last contribution, I think, pointed to the enduring significance of those residual memories. He talked about aggrieved nurses who'd seen their hospital knocked down, Indigenous people who'd seen their claim to country denied, in the context of this administrative construct that we live in, the ACT. Thinking back to his address this morning, it gave us a very useful reminder, I think, of the need to consider the tangible and the intangible. And that's one reason why Leanne's conference is here and not someone else, because museums are at the centre of that division of memory. And our curators, of course, understand both. They deal with both the intangible and the tangible often when they complete an acquisitions proposal and try and understand the stuff that they work with. He gave us some pertinent case studies, the Darjeeling Railway and Halong Bay especially, in which older people's memories were used. And again, I think that's one of the points I think needs to be teased out. It's crucial, but it's also complex. What's the relationship between the old person with the relevant memory and the professional's job who interprets it? And we had several examples through the day. Principally, I think, Claire Smith's paper, where she dealt with not just old people's memories, but old memories of an old people, and used those memories to understand the country they lived in, their relationship to that land. Again, there are themes that emerge from papers. Judy Slee alerted us to the complexities of memory, taking a cognitive, scientific approach, and really reminding all of us, and with me made me feel rather guilty, that I cheerfully talk about memory all day long, but I don't really know how it works as an electrical process in the brain. And I'm the only one making that admission, but I think we all share that deficiency, and we're grateful to her for giving us more. Mike Pickering, in that analytical way Mike has, challenged us to think more clearly and to analyse more closely the relationships between landscapes. Indeed, he gave us words that we often don't use about landscapes. He distinguished between landscapes and sites and locales, and he drew us diagrams which gave us ways to imagine those relationships. And I have to say, it's that kind of stimulus that makes days like this worthwhile for us, because it makes us see things in different ways. And it was at that point in the day's proceedings that I thought, gee, I wish we'd organised this 2 years before, because it would have given me a great deal more food for thought in my own work. Then another Pickering came along, Paul Pickering,
talking about memory and political power. And that became a theme in the day too, didn't it? In which he overturned simple-minded memories and talked about the construction of historical memories in political settings, looking at the 7/7 bombings, Guy Fawkes and Eureka. So the theme of political power and memories cropped up from time to time through the day. Well, skip my paper because you heard enough from me. I hope to show how fragile memory can be. The heat had almost gone from those memories by the affliction of time. And perhaps I'll have warmed it up a little bit, but we don't need to hear more. Claire Smith, what a profound knowledge of one group's relationship to the land Claire brought to us. The range and complexity of memories to, in a relatively small area, a great range and complexity of memories about places, from the traditional secret and sacred to informal new ways of remembering the past, and not just formal but informal ways. I was struck by the motorbike lying around, and I would have regarded it as junk, but clearly it had a meaning to those who were enabled to understand. After lunch, we had the panel on Reconciliation Place, which I think bore out the contention that this was a very successful collaboration between communities and government in a creative partnership. I think the most impressive thing, I think, was the evidence of the way in which all of those responsible, and most of them were sitting at the table, grappled with those complex ethical and cultural issues. And as Margot said, the fact that she wasn't brought in to advise suggests that perhaps they got it right. Then we had a very different situation. Paul House gave us a very clear demonstration of the significance of place in the continuing identity of Paul's people over a very long span of time. And again, a link to Amar's point about the importance of memories, that Paul gave us explicit connections to people in his family's, his people's past, who bore those memories and about whom he holds memories. So I don't think, I don't understand the problem. I still don't understand the problem, but I can recognize the profound sense of hurt that Paul bears. And again, we saw Paul Pickering's point about the political importance of memory. These aren't just things that make us feel good and are of interest and who give us some light reading. These are matters of profound importance for a people's identity and health. Well, what a contrast that was to Anne Farris's paper, which showed the beginning of a sense of place in a site in a very young city from the point of view of the people who occupied the medical superintendent's building. Anne's study looked like a microscopic study. It was only of one building, it seemed. But again and again, she showed the connections between the small story of MSB and the wider context of both the hospital, of the territory, of the city, of the people who come to Canberra. And that, it seems to me, is the essential task of those of us who seek to understand why memory is so important and why it is such a vital and compelling pursuit for people like us, and why Leanne had the genius to work out that this is something we needed to talk about. Which brings me to Leanne, who talked about inspirited sites, or surely allegedly inspirited sites. To be honest, the spirits are not worthy of respect. But I don't think. But what we need to take seriously is not the spirits, but the fact that people believe stories about the spirits, or at least pass these stories on. We may be skeptics, but it is interesting that people continue to share stories like this. And even though I may be skeptical, clearly it is a subject of legitimate interest. What we can all agree on, I think, is that memory and sites are clearly intimately connected, and that we think that relationship between place and mind and memory is of great interest. And we can agree that this discussion is good fun and it ought to continue, and I'm sure it will. Before I wrap up, I have a special announcement to make. Even though Margot's been so rude, I'm going to mention her conference, Barks, Birds and Billabongs, which is happening here at the National Museum from the 16th to the 20th of November. And it is a really extraordinary program that Margot's put together. Its ostensible subject is the 1948 Australian-American scientific expedition to Arnhem Land, and it looks at that that scientific venture from a whole range of perspectives. Margot's found international experts who are willing to come, usually on somebody else's money, to consider the anthropological, the ethnographic, the scientific, and not least the cultural dimensions of that encounter in Arnhem Land 60-odd years ago. And not least, of course, the indigenous experience and memory of that encounter between European, Australian and American scientists and the people of Arnhem Land. And I can only say that it's going to be about the three or four most interesting days we have in the course of this year. Five most interesting days. You might last five, Margot, but I certainly won't. Now, it falls to me to mention some thank yous. First of all, again, to Leanne, whose inspiration this conference has been, and to our colleagues in public programs and media operations and the Centre for Historical Research and no doubt many other bits of the museum who have made it happen. Secondly, to all speakers, and especially those who have come from a distance, Claire, Anna Marr, and thank you too to the chair people, Anne and Margot. Most of all, thank you very much to yourselves, those who have come to participate. Conferences, as I never tire of saying, are for conferring, and I thank you for doing so. Good afternoon.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.